Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the February 4th edition of the County Chronicle. We'll begin with the first page stories. Arcola City Council. Another alderman resigns from council, by Nolan Morse. The alder from Ward 1, Gilberto Moreno, resigned from the Arcola City Council Monday night, making him the second alderman, along with Matt Hansen, to resign in the last 2 months. When asked for comments about the resignation, Mayor Jesus Garza stated it was due to personal reasons and did not elaborate further. The council approved Dustin Ingham for the position of Public Works Director with a salary of $75,000 a year. Three applicants were interviewed on January 14th, each in 20-minute increments. Responsibilities for the position include planning, directing, and supervising the activities carried out by the Public Works Department, responding to emergency situations including water main breaks, severe weather events, and all other public safety concerns, coordination with contractors, engineers, and regulatory agencies, and more. A sewer rehab project on the west side of town is set to begin and be completed in the spring. Sewer laterals built out of clay tile will be removed and replaced with PVC pipe laterals. After construction is finished in the spring, the city will go through and redo the grass in the affected areas. An agreement with Mutual of Omaha for city worker dental insurance was passed. The complete charge covering every employee went up by $78 per month. The next article, Atwood Man Dies After Suffering Unspecified Injuries, by Doris Elmore. A male subject, later identified as Richard Gabbard of Atwood, was found unresponsive behind the former Atwood police station on South Main Street at approximately 12:50 a.m. on Friday, January 29th. The body was found by a passing train conductor. Law enforcement and EMS responded. Gabbard was transported to Carl Hospital in critical condition, suffering from multiple traumatic injuries and severe hypothermia. Gabbard succumbed to his injuries and died on Saturday, January 31st. The Atwood Police Department is investigating the death. The next article, Sex Offender Gets No Further Jail Time After Late Plea Deal, by Nolan Morse. Donald L. Pittman, Jr., of 47 of Tuscola, initially faced three felony charges of consisting of criminal sexual assault of a 13 to 17-year-old, aggravated criminal sexual assault where the defendant was more than 5 years younger than the victim, and aggravated criminal sexual abuse of a family member under 18. 30 minutes before his trial, with the jury in their seats, Pittman accepted a plea deal on January 20th that dropped two of the charges and let him walk away without further jail time. He was sentenced to 275 days time served in the county jail, 30 months court supervision, and must register as a sex offender. State's attorney Rob Kozik said it was a last-minute plea deal after every previous compromise was denied. The case the state had at their disposal relied heavily on testimony, he said, without sufficient amount of hard evidence to ensure a jury conviction. Due to the lack of tangible evidence, Kozik calculated the state didn't have enough strong enough case to convince the jury of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and made the decision that a plea bargain was safer than going to trial, risking a verdict of not guilty. Kozik agreed it was a light sentencing, but also stressed the importance of getting Pittman on the sex offender registry and stated that 30 months of court supervision was on the higher end. The charges of criminal sexual assault of a 13 to 17-year-old and the aggravated criminal sexual abuse where the defendant was more than 5 years older than the victim were dropped, and Pittman pled guilty to sexual abuse of a family member under 18. Pittman was fined $8,000 but credited that same amount for time served. Total fines and fees were assessed at $8,700, of which $676 remains due after making a $25 payment on January 27th. By agreement, he was ordered to pay $25 per month to the court. The next article, Two Librarians Retire with Smiles, by Nolan Morse. A retirement ceremony for Cheryl Switzer and Susie Saunders, two longtime employees of the Arcola Public Library, was held Sunday afternoon to celebrate two terrific careers. Susie started off in Arthur, then moved to the Lovington Library, where she served as director. After her departure from Lovington, Susie made her third and final stop in Arcola, where she would serve out the rest of her working years. In total, she spent 3 decades plus 3 years serving the three libraries, a 33 years of her life well spent. When asked her favorite part of the job, Susie smiled and said interacting with all the wonderful people she's met over the years. She had a hard time pinpointing her number one favorite novel, but expressed her love for the Mitford series and the author Jan Karen. Regardless of retirement, Susie has no plans of slowing down and will spend her newfound freedom spending time with her family, volunteering in her community, and traveling the world with her husband. Starting and sticking with Arcola her whole career, Cheryl began working in 1986. Then after 16 years, she was promoted to director of the Arcola Public Library, a title her mother once held, and one that Cheryl would retire with. Cheryl said that her proudest accomplishment in her 24 years serving as director was going through the process of getting IMRF, Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, for the Arcola Library. Her favorite part about the job as a whole, though, she said the same answer as Susie, seeing and meeting all the wonderful people throughout her 40 years. When asked her favorite book, Cheryl had to stop and think for a minute before coming up with A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. Though she's retiring, Cheryl still plans on spending her time at the library serving as director emerita, an honorable role. But with a little new time she's acquired, she plans to spend it with friends and family, especially her husband. In the last first page article, an idea that just keeps growing becomes Roadrunner Station by Nolan Morse. Pizzas cooked in under 5 minutes, decor that's handcrafted and picked from all across the country, and gaming in a side room. Camargo's newest restaurant, Roadrunner Station, offers a distinctly unique experience coupled with equally unique story. Attached to 3C's Automotive, the journey of Roadrunner Station began as a simple slot machine. Owner of both businesses, Dustin Carter, said it all started when he had the idea to include gaming in his auto body shop. Quickly halted by the law, Carter was required to first obtain a liquor license, which gave him the idea to open a small bar. Gaming would still be the primary focus, the bar just being a little add-on. Then, while he unassumingly sifted through Facebook, Dustin saw a post that would change his life. A wood oven stove for sale. Everyone thought it would be a back burner, and pizza became the core. Crafting his new idea for a restaurant, Dustin began scouring across the country for decor. Retro booths from the old Long John Silver's, a wooden paddle boat from Wisconsin, and stools that were styled in the 50s blend together. The theme is based around the rustic old car, something Dustin said he's always loved. Construction was the fun part. Learning how to run a restaurant was not, he said. His only food experience, being a busboy at 18, the hurdles began to pile up. 14 hours being spent on getting food license, complying with every rule and regulation set by the health department, and most challenging of all, learning how to use the wood oven stove. Thankfully, Dustin had someone with restaurant experience, a tow truck driver who previously worked at a pizzeria in California, and someone Dustin said he had been a huge help. When asked about the juggling act of running a machine shop and a new restaurant, Dustin again showed appreciation for his employees, saying he's been managing 3Cs for so long now he has multiple people he can trust to run while he focuses on Roadrunner Station. Opening up on January 27th, the early reviews have been uplifting and ideas for improvements have been flowing. Talks of adding cinnamon buns for breakfast and any other food experiment they can think up has been brought up. What started out as a little idea for gaming that turned into a full-scale restaurant brimming with its own unique personality. Dustin says his plan for the future is to just go with the flow and see what happens at the end of the road. The next article, Frank Porter celebrates 90th birthday in February. Frank Porter of Arcola, formerly of Tuscola, turns 90 on February 11th, and there'll be a family celebration on February 14th. Frank was born February 11th, 1936, in Newton to Andrew and Golda, nay Hume, Porter. After attending four different high schools, he graduated from Homer High School. His parents were educators at the grade school there. Known as Sonny to his family, he's the middle of five children who survived childhood. Two did not. Dr. Laurel Porter of Sparta, Eleanor the late Leon Harrest of Jacksonville, Alabama, Art Sharon Porter of Urbana, and Lorelei Sims of Wood River. He married Sarah Dallas in 1958. They have six children, Pete Muriel Porter in Burkeville, Texas, Roberta Mike Brennan of Tuscola, Sheila Jim Gustafson of Alton, Greg Porter of Tuscola, David Jenny Porter of Tuscola, and Matt Porter of Sandwich. Frank and Sarah have 16 grandchildren and step-grandchildren and numerous great and great-great-grandchildren. Frank studied engineering at the University of Illinois and began his career at USI Chemical in Tuscola. He also served in the National Guard. After 16 years at USI, he became an electrician at Ziegler Coal's company's old mine in Murdoch. After the mine closed, he worked for many years in a coal mine in Coulterville. While in Tuscola, he also owned and renovated numerous rental homes in Tuscola, Newman, and Homer. He built three homes in Tuscola, including one on Ohio Street, where he raised his family. In Sparta, he co-owned and renovated a 70,000-square-foot former school building. He was known for his thrift and as someone who could fix anything. He enjoyed working on small engines, cars, and houses. He enjoys puzzles, bingo, and playing cards, and is still a formidable card shark. Birthday cards will be sent to Frank Porter, care of Carriage Crossing, apartment 139-909 Green Mill Road, Arcola 61910. We'll move now to the obituaries. Glenda Abercrombie, 72, of Royal Tuscola, passed away at 3:57 p.m. on Wednesday, January 28, 2026, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Visitation was held Tuesday, February 3rd, at the Reynolds Funeral Home, Arcola. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, February 4th at the funeral home, 221 East Main Street in Arcola. Brother Randy Walters will officiate. Burial will be in the Cartwright Cemetery in rural Tuscola. Gertie R. Plank, 97 of Arthur, passed away at 6:30 a.m. on Monday, January 26, 2026 at Haven of Care in Arthur. Funeral services were held Thursday, January 29th at the HCK West Building south of Arthur. Bishop Marion Helmuth officiated. Burial was in the Otto Cemetery. Visitation was held Wednesday, January 28th at the HCK West Building. The Edwards Funeral Home assisted with arrangements. Patricia Lynn Campbell Mann of Tuscola passed away peacefully on January 27, 2026 at the age of 75. She was born on August 7, 1950. A funeral services was held Monday, February 2nd at the Joins Funeral Home in Villa Grove. Visitation was held prior to the funeral service at the funeral home. Burial was in the Camargo Cemetery. Memorial donations were made to Victory Church or St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Janet Wise Crandall, 96 of Cerro Gordo, passed away peacefully at 6:30 a.m. on January 27, 2026 at Heritage Woods, Sullivan. Born on January 21, 1930 in Decatur, Janet was the beloved daughter of Ralph and Gladys Wise. Visitation and celebration of life services were held Saturday, January 31st at the Cerro Gordo United Methodist Church. Graveside services followed at the Cerro Gordo Cemetery. Mary Elizabeth Connor, 94 of Hammond, passed away early Friday morning, January 23, 2026 at the Piatt County Nursing Home in Monticello. Celebration of life services will be held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, February 7th at the Hillegosh Schrader Funeral Home, 66 East U.S. Highway 36, Atwood, with Pastor Leland Legg officiating. Burial will follow the service at the Cartwright Cemetery, rural Tuscola. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. until the time of the service on Saturday. Roger Willis Rudder, 90 of Villa Grove, passed away peacefully on Thursday, January 29, 2026 at Newman Rehab and Healthcare Center in Newman. A visitation was held Saturday, February 1st at the Joints Funeral Home in Villa Grove. Graveside services were held at Locust Grove Cemetery in Philo. Memorial donations may be made to the family. The next article, accounts vary on Valentine Day's origins. Valentine's Day is a bright light in the middle of winter. Come February 14th, sweethearts celebrate their love and affection for one another in this day devoted to happy couples. The origin of Valentine's Day has generated much speculation over the years. Most early accounts do not point to heart-shaped boxes filled with chocolates. Rather, a few distinctive tales may paint the picture of early Valentine's Day and have nothing to do with stuffed animals or romantic dinners. Roman Festival. One of the earliest records of the term Valentine's Day is traced to the Roman festival of Lupercalia, which is a fertility festival. This annual event, held on February 15th, included animal sacrifices and priests called the Luperci, who would take pieces of animal hide and touch it to the foreheads of women in the hopes it would make them more fertile. Fortunately for the squeamish and the sacrificial animals, Pope Gelasius I ended Lupercalia and replaced it with St. Valentine's Day by the end of the 5th century. Two or three St. Valentines. Most people attribute the origins of Valentine Day to the holiday's namesake, St. Valentine, but it seems that Valentine was the surname of a few different individuals. According to History.com, the Catholic Church recognizes at least three different saints named Valentine or Valentinus. One Valentine was a priest during the reign of Emperor Claudius II, who decided that single men made better soldiers than those with families or wives. Claudius outlawed marriage for young men. Valentine disagreed with the decree and would perform marriages in secret. Others believed it was St. Valentine of Terni, a bishop beheaded by Claudius II outside of Rome, who was the true namesake. Yet another Valentine may have been jailed and fell in love with a jailer's daughter while in prison. He purportedly wrote to her beginning the first Valentine card or letter tradition. Other stories say the imprisoned Valentine actually was writing to a blind woman he purportedly healed and signed the note, "From your Valentine." It is hard to know who in regard to the name Valentine, as the stories and the people behind them are seldom used interchangeably. Some historians believe they actually are the same person rather than several different Valentines, while others insist there were multiple martyred individuals. However you slice it, the defiant actions of one or more people named Valentine set the course for centuries of romances to come. The next article, Illinois Amish Heritage Center announces the 2026 events. Sheep to Clothing to Quilts will return to the Illinois Amish Heritage Center on Saturday, May 2nd from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The event will feature sheep and alpaca shearing demonstrations, processing the wool, and making clothing and quilts from the shared materials. There will also be numerous activities for children, including pony cart rides and a petting zoo with various farm animals as well as household pets. A farmer's breakfast of pancakes, old-fashioned liverwurst, and grilled sausage will be offered for a fee starting at 7 a.m. In keeping with the theme, grilled lamb kebabs will be available for lunch, as well as hamburgers and other grilled sandwiches and fried foods. Baked goods, including homemade bread, cookies, cakes, pies, will be sold by a local Amish vendor. Craft demonstrations and activities, including sheep shearing, will begin at 9 a.m. The Charleston and Champaign Spinners and Weavers Guild will demonstrate the use of spinning wheels, drop spindles, stationary, and backstrap looms. There'll be wool washing and dyeing, and Amish ladies will join the women to demonstrate quilting and the making of quilts and coverlets. There'll be a laundry demonstrations featuring turn-of-the-century hand washer and wringer using water heated over an open fire. Visitors can try their hand at milking a goat, and other essential farm skills will be demonstrated, including chair caning, soap making, rope making, and gardening. Tours of the historic Amish buildings, the 1865 Yoder House, 1870 Schrock House, 1879 Hirschberger Mill and Barn, 1860s Yoder Workshop, 1930s German Schoolhouse, will field demonstrations and displays of the Amish way of life. Early Amish clothing, quilts, coverlets, and other hand-woven fabrics will be on display at the Schrock House, including a white and blue coverlet that was woven by the Diener family before they came to America in the 1830s. Also on display will be an 1890s era suit worn by Daniel Schrock at the time of his death in 1892, and the 1840s era Campbell family quilt, handmade entirely from local wool, dyed from plants, and then spun, woven, and quilted. Vendors will be stationed, as is customary, in the hay loft of the 1870s Hirschberger Miller Barn, where visitors can purchase a variety of gifts, including homemade soaps, jams and jellies, popcorn, crocheted crafts, dried herbs and flowers, hand towels, and more. There'll be beekeeper's booth, book card making, and the making of tissue paper flowers. Updates on all activities will be posted at the IAHC website, www.illinoisamish.org, and the Facebook Illinois Amish Heritage Center Facebook page. The IAHC is on Route 133, 3 miles west of Arthur and 5 miles west of the Arvarcola exit on I-57. Steam threshing days will be held on Friday, July 31st, and on Saturday, August 1st. Oats will be cut, bound, shocked, and threshed during a 19th century steam-driven engine threshing machine. Many additional harvest activities and demonstrations take place during the festival. Watch the IAHC website and digital media closer to the event for more details. Additionally, the IAHC will produce smaller monthly events throughout the year, such as All About Horses, Amish Education, a German spelling bee, storytelling, and a return of the popular 2025 old-fashioned Christmas in the one-room schoolhouse. Watch their website and social media pages for event dates and details. In 2026, the IAHC Living History Farm will be open to the public every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., May through October. Docents will lead guided tours. Reservations are not necessary, but there is an admission fee. The new visitor center and Amish museum is slated to open in the fall to house the story of Anabaptism and the Amish. The original exhibition from when the Illinois Amish Heritage Center was located in Arcola in the 1990s and Rockholm Gardens in the 2000s. The next article is from Ramblin' Man Dave Porter, Hoard of Abhorred Cords Stored on the Floor. There are cords all over my home office, which is not the aesthetic that we want, but as wireless as we are, devices still need to charge their batteries. I suppose I could hide the cords away and create a charging station, which we sort of did in the laundry room. We have a little table tucked away in a corner that holds the internet router and base for my wireless thermometer. It also has chargers for my camera, battery, my wife's book light, a little vacuum, etc. But some devices go through the juice faster than others, and I don't want to be working in my office and suddenly have to power up my computer or cell phone. I want the chargers at my fingertips. There are also cords that power my easy chair, a small heater, the TV, another monitor. Functionality wins over aesthetics. My wife's phone uses the same charger as mine. She sits across from me, so I pass the cord back and forth as needed. Sometimes the unthinkable happens, a first world problem of the highest order. One of us will use a phone charger and not return it when we're done. By one of us, I mean both of us. So I'm sitting in my easy chair where I spend my, maybe 98% of my day, and my phone signals that it's out of power. I reach for the charger and it's not there. I see it. It's on the floor in front of my feet. I look down at the charging cord on the floor in front of me and think to myself, well, I guess my phone battery is going to die. Now I know what you're thinking. Just retrieve it. Get on with your day. But that is more involved than you might think. First, I have to put my footrest down. It's electric, so it's not an automatic thing. I have to press a button on the side of the chair as the footrest slowly descends with a gentle buzz. That will take, oh, maybe 5 seconds. Next, I have to set my cigar down and lift the computer off my lap, set it down on the table that's 5 feet in front of me, being careful to set the cursor to make sure the screen doesn't go to sleep, lest I have to reset it, which may require placing my index finger on the biometric sensor. How primitive. Then, and this is the hard part, I have to bend over or squat down to pick up the cord. This would require using muscles, not vigorously, but muscles all the same. Then I would have to reverse the earlier moves, retrieve the laptop, sit back down, slowly extend the footrest, hoping that it hits the same spot where it was before for maximum comfort. The footrest, the back of the chair, and the headrest all have to line up, not to mention how far back I sit in the seat. It's not a Cadillac where I can save my preferred settings. You know how it is when somebody messes with your seat in the car and it takes forever for you to find your spot. Like, you know, 10 or 15 seconds. It's a burden. Then I would need to retrieve my cigar, probably have to relight it, and then remember what I was doing, what I'd been working on, and that's when it hits me that I should have used the bathroom when I was up, and now I have to go through the whole footrest thing again. I know it's pathetic, but all of the deadly sins, sloth is the one I'm best at. I've got them all covered, but sloth is the top. You literally won't have to do anything to commit the deadly sin of sloth. We have since fixed the problem of the phone cord. My wife now has her own. With one more cord to trip over, on the bright side, I can't trip over the cord if I never leave my chair. And if it wasn't for the bathroom breaks, I probably never would. The next article, providers say Fed's new rural health care grants to Illinois won't cover Medicaid costs. State receives second smallest grant among neighboring states. By Nicole Hytrek. Illinois will receive $193 million for each of the next 5 years to expand health care access for approximately 1.9 million people in rural areas, or about $101 annually for each rural Illinoisan. The money comes from the $50 billion Federal Health Care Transformation Program Fund, which Congress created to offset federal Medicaid spending cuts included in the One Big Beautiful Bill, or at the H.R. 1 that passed last summer. But healthcare organizations said the money will not be enough to compensate for Medicaid cuts. These funds are good and we're going to put them to good use, but it's not a solution, said Jordan Powell, Senior Vice President of Health Policy and Finance for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. It's not going to mitigate the impact of the significant Medicaid cuts that are coming our way. The Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services said between 190,000 to 360,000 Medicare recipients are at risk of losing coverage in Illinois because of the new work requirements. H.R. 1 also imposed a tighter cap on how much money can raise for Medicaid programs through provider taxes. The new limits will be phased in starting in fiscal year 2028 and could reduce total Medicare funding in Illinois by $45 billion a year by fiscal 2031. Long term, we know a number of H.R. 1 provisions will have devastating impact on health care in our state and present significant challenges with respect to maintaining equitable access to high-quality health care coverage for all Illinois residents, the department said in a statement. Illinois has 85 small and rural hospitals that serve as hubs for access care for people who can't travel long distances. Nearly 30% operate at a deficit, though, and most of the patients they serve are on Medicare or Medicaid, according to the Health and Hospital Association. Powell described the new federal money as a bandage, not a permanent solution for the cuts Illinois hospitals will face. As Medicaid reimbursements decreases, he said hospitals will be forced to reduce services like obstetrics, cut staff, or close entirely. Rural population is only a small part of the grant consideration. The amount each state received ranged from $147 million for New Jersey to $281 million for Texas, and rural population appeared to be the only small factor in the equation. That means states like Texas, with largest rural population in the country, got far less per rural resident than states like Rhode Island, which has the smallest. Texas received $66 per rural resident, and Rhode Island, with a total award of $156 million, received $6,000 per resident. Half of the total $50 billion was awarded to states equally, but the other half was awarded based on specific factors, such as states' current or planned policies for rural health care, proposed ideas that align with federal Make America Healthy Again priorities. Among its neighbors, Illinois has the second lowest award amount. Michigan, with $173 million award, is the only state with less. In the Midwest, Michigan's rural population is slightly larger than Illinois', but it received only $83 per person compared to Illinois' $101. Iowa, with fewer rural residents than Illinois, got $139 per rural person. Illinois priorities. When filling out the application to the federal government, Illinois' HFS consulted provider associations, rural hospitals, community health centers, community mental health centers, universities and community college, legislators, and vendors. According to the department, the state's application focused on increasing the number of healthcare workers in rural areas with education, scholarship, training, and incentive programs, removing the barriers that rural residents face to getting healthcare by investing in mobile and telehealth services, changing the way rural health care systems run by creating regional partnerships. The federal government indicated a preference for transforming systems, not just supporting ongoing operating expenses. HFS said the hospital transformation grant will be a good tool for expanding its existing health care transformation collaboratives to rural areas. The state launched the collaborative effort in 2021 to improve health care outcomes and reduce disparities across the state. It involves providers sharing resources to meet the health needs of multiple communities and expand access to services like preventative and specialty care. Team-based care, in partnership with hospitals and primary care practices, looks to improve access to care for rural residents by building out infrastructure and technology in order to increase access to specialty services, transform healthcare delivery, and overcome known geographic barriers for these communities, the agent said in an email statement. Powell said increasing the workforce and cybersecurity at hospitals are some of the top priorities. After that, he said expanding rural broadband internet and upgrading electronic health records are important. Workforce and technology were two of the main things we learned from our members, he said. I think the state wants to emphasize better partnerships and collaboration between providers. Not a long-term fix. Despite allowing rural hospitals and health systems to make needed improvements, Powell said he still doesn't think of the money will be enough to make up for losing Medicaid payments. It's kind of a supplement funding that's going to help them survive just a little bit longer, he said. I would actually say a significant portion of them are facing slim to negative margins as it is. And so this funding that again will maintain some stability and viability for those organizations, but it is not a long-term fix. In the next article, new SNAP work requirements going to affect February 1st, threatening recipient eligibility, by Jenna Schweikert. New work requirements for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program going to affect February 1st, threatening benefits for hundreds of thousands of Illinoisans. Adults aged 18 to 64 without dependents under age 14 will be required to work, participate in SNAP employment and training programs, or volunteer for at least 80 hours per month to receive benefits. Previously, only adults aged 18 to 54 without dependents under age 18 had to meet these requirements. H.R. 1, known as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, sets these new SNAP requirements and made changes to many other federal programs when it was signed into law July 2025. Up to 340,000 Illinoisans are at risk of losing their benefits with the new requirements, according to the Illinois Department of Human Services. Adults who do not meet the requirements can only receive SNAP benefits for 3 months in a three-year period. As of September 2025, nearly 2 million Illinois residents were using SNAP benefits, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Two major changes to SNAP. Most SNAP recipients must meet general work requirements by applying for and accepting available work, participating in SNAP employment and training, and not voluntarily quitting or reducing their work hours below $30 a week without good reason. Some recipients are automatically exempt from this requirement based on factors like age, while others must submit exemption forms if they meet other criteria like homelessness or certain health conditions. A smaller group of SNAP recipients, known as ABAWDs, or able-bodied adults without dependents, must meet further requirements if they are not exempt. H.R. 1 made two major changes by modifying the definition of ABAWDs, implementing more work requirements for the newly defined population, ending Illinois' long-term work requirements waiver for existing ABAWDs, according to IDHS. Trump's budget is designed to deliberately prevent Americans and Illinoisans from receiving assistance through the SNAP program by implementing new requirements that burden states and individuals rely on this 100% federally funded benefits resource, that Summer Griffiths, a spokesperson for IDHS, said in a statement. And that is all the time we have for this week. This is Chris Yerkes saying goodbye, and see you again next week.